Good morning. It's good to see you. It's really nice to see you all. I see a lot of people at Zen Center during Zazen during the week, but I have to miss quite a few Sundays, so there's some people here I don't see that often, and it's really sweet. I have to like look through a couple screens here just so I can see everybody, which will I recommend for you all. We have to find ways to connect here, I think. I mean, we're already only connected, but I don't always feel that way. And I'd just like to say, however you are, I'm glad you're here. You know, you may be feeling very joyful or very peaceful, or you might be feeling sad or angry or despairing, might be grieving, might be just pretty chill. However you are, that's okay. We're together. This is Sangha, community. So today, my theme is inherent liberation. Inherent liberation. And this is based in the rather strange but really central Mahayana idea that everything is already liberated. Nothing can be bound, including everything that you would consider part of yourself or external to yourself. And this is it's not the way we usually look at the world, I don't think. In the opening line of Dogen's Universal Recommendation for Zazen, he says, the opening lines, "The way is originally perfect and all-pervading. How could it be contingent on practice and realization? The true vehicle is self-sufficient. What is there need for special effort? Indeed, the whole body is free from dust. Who could believe in a means to brush it clean? It is never apart from this very place. What is the use of traveling around to practice?" It's already here. This is how he begins his recommendation for why we should do Zazen. In the Yogacara teachings, we say everything is already of a complete realized nature. It's complete, it's whole, it's realization. So it's what Buddhas see. And Buddhas see a world that's free, where they are not bound. They are not binding. In the Vimalakirti Sutra, the great mythical lay practitioner Vimalakirti says, "The nature of all things is liberation." Do we believe this? I don't know. Sometimes, maybe. So last year, I found myself giving a Dharma talk in Washington, D.C. for the Insight Meditation Community of Washington. And as I often do when I'm teaching a group that is predominantly white people, I was, like myself, I was emphasizing the central thesis of the earliest Buddhist teachings, which is that there's suffering in the world, and you can do something about it. So I often will emphasize recognizing suffering and that we have agency, because there are many conditions that produce complacency around many forms of suffering in white people, because we have a system that's designed to sort of make it nice for us while producing suffering for people who are not white. And it's the same thing for like men like me. So, you know, I'm like, in those contexts, I don't want people to just be like, "Oh, everything's fine. I'll just let it all be." Because, you know, people are suffering. It's very evident. If you listen, you'll hear people are suffering. So anyway, I often have this theme, and then also the theme that there's suffering in the world and you can do something about it is is so central to early Buddhist teachings. This is my main way of summing up the Four Noble Truths in the most simple, concise manner. There's suffering in the world, and you can do something about it. I really believe this. And actually, this lives in really close harmony with the idea that everything is inherently liberated. So the Heart Sutra is the most kind of like, arguably the most central text of Zen Buddhism, and I've chanted it on Tuesday and Thursday mornings where I attend Zazen each week, just hundreds of times, maybe thousands. And it's an enigmatic text, but its central idea is how to alleviate suffering, because it is the teaching of Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of compassion. How do we manifest compassion in the ultimate way from a Mahayana or a Zen perspective? And then it just goes on to say that there's nothing that can be controlled. There's nothing that can be bound. Everything is free because it's not even a thing. So I'm not going to unpack the Heart Sutra at great length. Some of you are already familiar with it, and some of you can just maybe become curious. But, you know, it says there's no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no consciousness, no suffering, no path out of suffering, no attainment. Everything that Buddhism has given you as ways to frame things, the Heart Sutra says none of them are ultimately true, and none of them have ultimate separate existence. There's nothing to grasp. There's nothing to control. And that analysis includes everything that we would consider personal to ourselves and everything that we consider separate from ourselves. Free. So, Cesar Chavez, the great leader with Dolores Huerta of a workers' rights movement in the United States, once said, "Nonviolence is not inaction. Inaction is in a, like non-action. Nonviolence is not non-action." Nonviolence is not inaction. So you might think like, oh, if everything's free, like why would I do anything? This is actually the reason Dogen raises the inherent freedom of everything at the beginning of his universal recommendation for Zazen. Why should we do things? Because they're already liberated. I know that's a little bit of a strange construction, but Buddhism is pretty challenging. It's pretty challenging to a lot of our regular ways of looking at things. Nonviolence is deeply tied, in my mind, to what bell hooks calls non-domination, or what I will call in the context of this talk, non-control. Non-control. Controlling, violence, domination, all ways that we're trying to construct a world that will be pleasing to the way we happen to want it to be. Cesar Chavez is a guy who is able to do some really amazing work in the face of unbelievably pervasive systemic harm in a way that is pretty inspiring. Nonviolence, non-control, non-domination. What does it look like? So I'm saying, like, what does it look like if someone begins to realize that they're not in control and they're not controlled? So from a Mahayana perspective, this realization that there are no things to control and no thing which can be controlled is basically central to why the Buddha was called Buddha. Well, that's like what the awakening was. And then what happened when the Buddha had this awakening? Well, the Buddha devoted the rest of his life to serving the community. To everyone who came to him, he would just stop and meet them as best he could in a way to help them be free. And he lived a homeless life. He lived a very meager life, begging for food once a day. And to all that, you know, this is all mythical, but he seemed to live a pretty happy life. totally available. Very simple. In the Avatamsaka Sutra, the Flower Garland Sutra, Hua Yen Sutra, this is a very long sutra, which is the story of, revolves around the story of a young man named Sudana who has an aspiration for awakening. And the aspiration for his awakening is described in terms that you're like, if I had that experience, I would be as enlightened as I ever need to be. So he has this amazing awakening. And then he's like, wow, what I want to do is practice and learn how to practice realization. And so he finds Maitreya, who's a Buddha, and Maitreya's like, oh yeah, well, you should just go talk to this Bodhisattva. And the story of the, well, actually I'm talking about the Gandavyuha, not the whole Avatamsaka. So just the last section of the Avatamsaka. It's called the Gandavyuha. In this thing, Sudana visits something like 70 Bodhisattvas, and every one of them describes some absolutely incredible attainment of letting go of any sense of controlling and being controlled. And then everyone says, but you know, what do I know? If you really want to embody this, you need to keep going. You need to keep going and go talk to this other person who will elucidate it in a way that's even more powerful and beautiful. But at every step of the way, each instance includes this thematic material of the inherent liberation of everything already, that there aren't things that can be controlled within or without you. So, you know, we feel controlled. I feel persecuted or victimized or impinged upon. We feel as like I feel controlled by the weather. The weather is bad, so I can't do what I want to do. I feel controlled by the political environment. I feel controlled by my family. You know, we feel this, feel controlled. And then like, I want to control things. Is there anyone here who has any desire to control the outcomes of any large-scale future activities in the United States? Perhaps. Perhaps we do. Do you think you're in control? And yet, there's suffering in the world and you can do something about it. So we feel controlled. We want to control. Sometimes I am in control. I'm a recovering addict and alcoholic. Yeah, I was into control. I know how I'm going to feel. I know how intoxicated and okay I'm going to feel because I know how high I'm going to get. Feel control, or like you think maybe I'll be in control if I can get everyone around me to be to stop being so messed up. We call that codependency. Or we feel control. We're like, I'm super good at ham radio. Yeah. And I watched the movie Silver Linings Playbook last night. Robert De Niro is he's got it all figured out. If he gets all the people around him in the right way, his football team will win and everything will be fine and his family will be coherent. We're like this. We're like this. We construct a view of the world where we can have an illusion of control, but it's binding. It's binding. So, the cool thing is, I forgot to complete the story. I'm usually pretty organized. I forgot to complete the story, I think, of being at the Insight Meditation Community in Washington. I was talking about how we have the capacity to do something beneficial. And afterwards, this woman came up. She's a black woman, and she said, I liked your talk. It was good. I liked it. She's like, but you know, I'm also a Lutheran. I'm not just a Buddhist, but I'm also a Lutheran. And she said, for me, I need grace. I need grace. I have a faith tradition that says there's already infinite love and goodness, and I don't have to do anything to make it happen. And I realized I am not teaching Buddhism as well as I should. I tend to forget the complete realized nature. I tend to forget the message of the Heart Sutra, that it's already complete, that liberation is here. But here's something I really love about Buddhism is that actually the way we just have all these like rational evidence for why everything is already liberated. So I'll use one kind of standard model for rationally describing why everything is already liberated and nothing can be controlled. Control is an illusion. Let's talk about purchasing a telephone. Now, this is something just 30 years ago, this would have meant something different. But anyway, you purchase a phone. So when you purchase something, the idea is we believe we possess it. And possession basically comes down to feeling like we have control over the object. We get to determine, what is done with it and how it's used and so forth. So we're like, I have a phone. I am in control of the phone. This is like, duh. How could you argue that? Well, let's think about it. In Buddhism, we often use analysis or regression, or sometimes called reductio ad absurdum, in order to point to why you don't have control. So one, you have the control of the phone, so you're like, great, I have the phone, I'm using it. Now, when you use it, you're like, I'm controlling what's happening. But what you may or may not be noticing is that there are many, many extremely complex entities, every time you use it, gathering data from your use for their purposes. By the way, in order to try and control you, right? So your data is being mined at an incredible rate. Where you are is always tracked, unless you're very careful to avoid the tracking device on your phone. The activities, the thing you search for, the things you talk about, all of it's, and I'm not, this is just like well known. This is how phones work. It's actually how they're paid for, is by extracting your information. So we think, I'm like, I'm in control of this. But it's like, well, am I in control of that? Can that be somehow separated from what I did when I controlled the phone? And likewise, like, how about, there's no way that phone existed without someone figuring out how to make phones. So are you in control of the process by which the phone came to you? The process by which the people communicated to you that you need a phone? The process by which someone mined all the petroleum to make the plastics in the phone, or not mined, but, however they get it up, or mine the metals, and wait a minute, like, are you in control of the, like, people whose livelihoods are dependent on the phone products? And, of course, I hope this line of reasoning is familiar to you. It's really, and you might be like, I've heard these, everything's dependent on everything a million times. I think the possibility is incredibly remote that you have taken this in sufficiently. Incredibly remote. Every single instant that we think we're controlling something, we have to ignore infinite or at least near infinite things which we're not controlling in order to construct the sense that we have control. You can apply this to every single element of your experience. Anytime you think there's control, you have to actively, probably unconsciously, ignore, because of your conditioning, infinite other things to create the illusion that you have control. But you can do something, and you're free. You can be free. I'm going to read you a little Dharma here. This is from The Mind of Mahamudra. This book is really amazing. If you're like a serious Buddhist nerd who likes to read primary texts, Mahamudra is basically like Zen with instructions. It's really cool. So I just want to read you a little passage here. Mahamudra is a Tibetan tradition. It's a, kind of the one of the most core meditative traditions in the Tibetan Buddhism. Anyway, I'll read you this verse from The Bright Torch. If you do not know that whatever appears is meditation, how can you attain it through relying on some kind of remedy? You cannot eliminate objects and conditions by eliminating them. But if you know they are illusions, they are spontaneously liberated. I'll read that again. If you do not know that whatever appears is meditation, how can you attain it through relying on some remedy? You cannot eliminate objects and conditions by eliminating them. But if you know they are illusions, they are spontaneously liberated. So just thematically, meditation in our tradition is the shedding of conception so that we actually affectively know that there are no objects to be controlled and we are not an object which can be controlled. And this is an invitation to realize that this way of meditation is available in any moment of your life. And then instead of being like, oh, I got to fix myself. I got to fix the situation. I got to destroy this and get rid of that. Dominate, violence, control. I can actually just realize all the ideas I have it aren't ultimately true. There's freedom right here. Freedom for the energy of my life to move in a natural way of liberation. I have too much material here. There's so much cool Dharma out there, everybody. Well, let's do this. Bodhidharma, who's like the sort of quasi-mythical founder of Zen, it's not the moment of transmission, but kind of a moment of incredible meeting between Bodhidharma and Huayca, his primary student. Huayca says, Bodhidharma, my mind, there's so much suffering. Can you pacify my mind? And Bodhidharma says, oh, sure. He says, bring me your mind. Bring me your mind. Is there a locatable thing which can be controlled? He just says, bring me your mind. Huayca says, there's like people say, oh, he thought about it for a long time or something, but the actual case record, just Huayca just says, I've looked and I can't find it. Bodhidharma says, oh, then I've pacified it. Once there's not a thing, there's nothing that can be bound. There have to be things which we think are ultimately real for there to be control, for there to be binding. Okay, so classic Zen poem from lay woman Chen from China. She wrote, up on the high slopes, I see only woodcutters. Everyone has the spirit of the knife and the axe. How can they see the mountain flowers reflected in the water, glorious, red? Up on the high slopes, I see only woodcutters. Everyone has the spirit of the knife and the axe. How can they see the mountain flowers reflected in the water, glorious, red? She feels sad. She feels it. Just seeing something beautiful and illusory and impermanent, a mountain flower in the water. I've seen, when you see reflections in water, they don't last. You can't grab them. Classic image in Zen paintings of a monkey trying to grab at the moon in the water. That's us. I love monkeys. I love us. The spirit of the knife and the axe. Control, domination. Look at our planet. doesn't have to be this way. And Laywoman Chen, she has this way of seeing. She sees control and domination. She sees the ungraspability of things. It's beautiful, but it's kind of sad to see everybody. Yeah. See everybody struggling. But she takes action. Her action, in this case, is to write a poem. A poem. And you might be like, no, poems are not enough. True, nothing is enough. Just keep going. But, Miss Sudhana, just keep going. Audre Lorde, the great lesbian womanist, essayist, and poet, wrote a absolutely phenomenal essay called Poetry is Not a Luxury. Poetry is not a luxury. And in this, she says, as we learn to bear the intimacy of scrutiny and to flourish within it, as we learn to use the products of that scrutiny for power within our living, those fears which rule our lives and form our silences begin to lose their control over us. I'll just read that again. As we learn to bear the intimacy of scrutiny and to flourish within it, as we learn to use the products of that scrutiny for the power within our living, those fears which rule our lives and form our silences begin to lose their control over us. The intimacy of scrutiny. So she's talking about, this is partway through the essay, she's talking about that poetry is an activity of scrutinizing, of really deeply looking at experience. And that looking must have expression. Doesn't that sound like Zen? The first Katagiri book says, returning to silence. The second one says, you have to say something. It's perception activity. But this intimacy of scrutiny, that sounds a little bit like Zen practice to me. I sit and I have to kind of put up with all the weird stuff that emerges in my consciousness. That's what Zazen is like for me. It's like, where did that come from? That's not the mind I wanted. And I learned to be like, oh, I can really be with the whole of who I am. I don't have to hide from it. And then we do that in intimacy with other people. We find a teacher and we are real with them. We are real with them. And we do it in community. We flourish within it. We begin to be able to flourish within this, really looking within intimacy. I just like to see, we begin to see power within our living. That's Audre Lorde's words, power within our living. We have power just in our living. She doesn't say we begin to have the power to control external objects. We have power just within our natural expression. And then she talks about not being controlled. Those fears which rule our lives begin to lose their control over us. We lose the sense that we're controlled and that we're controlling, but we awaken to a natural power of agency. This is what this practice is about for me. So another poet, Diane de Prima. I don't know Diane de Prima's poetry that well, but apparently she's got about 22 published books of poetry. I mean, I knew the name, but I stumbled across this poem by Diane de Prima, which I'm going to read. And I will say, it's in this book. I'm just going to be honest. This book really, I've had a really not good feeling looking at this book because it's Buddhism and Contemporary American Poetry, and I think there are like 50 poets and every one of them is white. We need to do better. And there are some collections where that is not the case. However, there are some really beautiful poems in here. And this one is by Diane De Prima. And yeah, it's just a very simple encounter. If you don't know, Katagiri Roshi was the person who founded the Minnesota Zen Meditation Center, and in whose lineage I am ordained through Tim Burkett. So, she writes this poem called A Visit to Katagiri Roshi. A pleasure. We talk of here and there. Gossip about the folks in San Francisco. Laugh a lot. I try to tell him to tell someone what my life is like. The hungry people, the trying to sit zazen in motels, the need in America like a sponge sucking up whatever prana and courage. Pray to the bodhisattvas, says Katagiri Roshi. I tell him that sometimes traveling, I am too restless to sit still. I wiggle and itch. Sit only 10 minutes, 5 minutes at a time, he says. First time it has occurred to me that this would be okay. As I talk, it becomes okay. There becomes some continuity in my life. I even understand or remember why I'm on the road. As we talk, a continuity, a transfer of energy takes place. It is darshan, a blessing, transmission of some basic joy, some way of seeing, like a tangible gift in the hand, in the heart. It stays with me. It doesn't seem like they did all that much. But it clearly mattered. Diane De Prima was on the road sharing her poetry. Life of an itinerant teacher and poet. But just this encounter. Neither one seemed to be trying to make the other one into something else. There was some encouragement. But it's just meeting. It's just meeting. So, you know, a lot of my friends are very discouraged. Yeah, very discouraged. I've had a lot of friends who are just like, I just got emails yesterday, you know, I'm just in despair. What do I do? Oh, Lord. Yeah. Yeah. Smart. Maybe you're not. Maybe you're energized. That's great, too. Or maybe you're like, I don't know, I'm just fine. No big deal. But to my mind, Buddhism, Zen Buddhism, Buddhism from the broadest perspective, calls us into recognizing there's suffering and you can do something about it, and everything is inherently liberated. You can't control things and you can't be controlled. Vimalakirti says, all things by nature are liberation. Normally the translations I find of texts like this say liberated. I love all Vimalakirti's wisdom. It's liberation. It's activity. Activity. We can jump into the activity. And, you know, if you get discouraged, you know, you're like, my practice stinks. I'm not getting any better. Or the USA stinks. I'm just going to go in my basement and not talk to anyone for 3 months. Whatever you are. Angela Davis once wrote, sometimes we have to do the work even though we can't yet see a glimmer of hope on the horizon that it's going to be possible. Sometimes we have to do the work even though we can't yet see a glimmer of hope on the horizon that it's going to be possible. I'm just saying we can start to be people who don't have to have any hope. I'm not waiting. I can try and be a person who's not waiting, who's just here and is like, well, what can I do? Not waiting for the outcome of something I've controlled. Not waiting for myself to be better, to finally be good enough. There is no waiting in Zen. Zazen is pretty good for this. You know, we just sit and we can actually maybe have even like a tiny moment that we don't even recognize, where our mind or our habits of consciousness haven't turned the world into a bunch of objects, turned ourselves into an object, turned something we're imagining into an object, turned something we're hearing into an object. Oh, I do like bird songs when I'm meditation. Oh, I don't like sirens. Whatever, it's just, it doesn't have to be an object. And then Zazen, more than anything I've ever met, opens up the possibility of starting to really see through that. And it's not the whole, then there's many other things we can do in relationship to other people. So this ability to realize that things are inherently liberated is something that can naturally arise and we can cultivate and can begin to pervade our lives.